I invite your attention this morning to the 77th Psalm as we speak on the theme, the apparent absence of God. And I want us to begin by reading, beginning in the 7th verse. The psalmist asks, "Will the Lord cast off forever? And will he be favorable no more? Is his mercy clean gone forever? Doth his promise fail forevermore? Hath God forgotten to be gracious? Hath he in anger shut up his tender mercies?" Selah. One of the first things that I learned as a young believer was that God was omnipresent. In fact, I think one of the first sermons I ever preached when I was exercising for the ministry was on the omnipresence of God. The prefix omni means all. Present, of course, means present. God is all present. He's everywhere present at the same time and nowhere absent. God fills heaven and earth, says the prophet Jeremiah. It's the thrilling attribute of God that says that God is not far from every one of us. But just to be real honest with you, through the years of personal experience, there have been occasions in my life in which, even though I've known that God is omnipresent, that he is simultaneously and perpetually near, there was a disconnect between what I knew to be true and what I felt in my own experience. You know, there's a difference between the omnipresence and the felt presence of God. God is everywhere at the same time. That's a fact, but we don't always sense it, do we? There are times in our life, in fact, in which we have an overwhelming sense of the apparent absence, not the presence of God in our lives. The late R.C. Sproul said that Christians today often have a profound sense of the absence of God. We see no burning bushes. There is no pillar of cloud to lead us by day. There is no pillar of fire that leads us by night. There is no incarnate Christ walking in our midst. We have to live by faith, don't we? Not by sight. Perhaps you've said before, I wish I could be like the Old Testament saints and have visible manifestations of God's presence. Wish I could see an angel. Wish I could hear an audible voice. I wish there was a theophany, like a pillar of cloud that tells me where to go and when to go and where to stop and when to stop. But we have to live by the Word of God, don't we? We don't always feel the sense of God's presence. Sometimes it seems that he is silent. Sometimes it seems that God is disconnected. Sometimes we feel that he's remote. Have you ever prayed and you felt that your prayers did not rise any higher than the top of your head or the ceiling of your house? And you thought, I just can't seem to find God. How wonderful to know that God knows where we are in times like that, though. You may not know where he is, but he knows where you are. Job said it like this in Job 23:10. I go forward, and he's not there. Backward, but I cannot find him. On the left hand, where he doth work, I cannot perceive him. He hideth himself on the right hand, that I cannot find him. He says, but he knoweth the way that I take. Job says, I'm looking for God. Forward, backwards, up, down, all around, and I can't find him anywhere, but he knows the way that I take. And when he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold. Now, old writers used to refer to these experiences in the lives of Christian people in terms of the dark night of the soul, or in terms of the hidings of God's face. Have you ever gone through your concordance and looked up that expression, God hiding his face? Isaiah 59 verse 2 says, the Lord's hand is not shortened that it cannot save, his ear is not heavy that it cannot hear, but our iniquities have hidden his face from us. Now in that particular case, the prophet says that the reason God has withdrawn his felt presence and is hiding himself from us is because of our sins. And there are other reasons that God might hide from us, as our psalm is going to indicate to us today. But yet this experience is common in the life of normal Christians. You're not abnormal if you go through seasons in your life in which it seems that the heavens are brass, your prayers can't penetrate, God is distant, remote, disconnected. We have a profound sense of the silence of God, of the absence of God, like our text says. Is the Lord clean gone forever? Will he be favorable no more? Will the Lord cast off forever? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Now that's the experience of the psalmist in this 77th psalm. May I issue a warning though, when you start having these kinds of thoughts, the feeling that God is nowhere to be found in your life, especially when you're facing particular troubles and problems in your life, may I say that that's a time to be very cautious, because you're treading on thin ice when you start asking, is the Lord clean gone forever? It's not abnormal to wonder where the Lord is, to sense that he's absent, that he's withdrawn himself. But yet when we start asking these questions, let's remember, dear friends, that we have to be extremely cautious. But at the same time, if true religion is not equipped to face these hard questions that real people who live in a real world have, then I dare say that it's not much use to us unless it's equipped to face them. And that's one thing that I appreciate about the psalmist. You'll notice in the caption above Psalm 77, it says, this is a psalm of Asaph. You say, I thought David wrote the psalms. He wrote the majority of them. But you remember what the psalms were? They were the hymn book of the ancient Hebrews. And just as you'll notice in our hymn book, we have hymns that were written by a particular author. For instance, there are a number of hymns by William Cowper or by John Newton, the man who wrote Amazing Grace and How Sweet the Name of Jesus Sounds, or Isaac Watts. But you'll also find hymns in here by other lesser known authors, right? There are some hymns in here by people like George Crowley, Fanny J. Crosby, and Sarah Adams, who wrote Nearer My God to Thee. Some of these people only wrote one song that is included in our hymnal. But you say, Brother Mike, there's a variety of hymns, but they're written by different particular writers. The same is true in the Psalter. Most of the psalms were written by David, but there are a few of them that were written by others. In fact, Psalm 77, our text this morning, appears in a section of psalms that were written by this man named Asaph. A psalm of Asaph. And you might ask, Brother Mike, who is Asaph? Well, Asaph was the song leader of the children of Israel under the Old Testament. He was what some would call the minister of music. He was responsible, he and his family, they were Levites, priests, and they were responsible for music in the worship services of the Old Testament tabernacle and later the temple. You can read about him in the 16th chapter of 1 Chronicles. Asaph was what we would call the choir director when David was king over Israel. And he wrote several of these psalms. Of course, somebody that's interested in music is interested not only in the performance of it, but sometimes there are actually composers as well. Asaph was such a person. And you have a series of 11 psalms here in this section of the Psalter, beginning with Psalm 73, going through Psalm 83. And one of the things that I appreciate about this man, Asaph, the author of this psalm, is that he is a brutally honest person about his inward trials. You know, most of us wear a mask, right? I do. I come to church and I put on my Amazing Grace smile. And people say, how are you doing? I'm doing great. But on Tuesday afternoon, I may not be doing so great. You know, on Thursday morning, I may be struggling a little bit. Most of us wear a mask. Asaph, though, I like people who are brutally honest. I like people who are real, don't you? Asaph doesn't put on any airs. He doesn't give the impression that he has everything under control. He doesn't operate by the principle that all is well. Asaph is very realistic, and therefore he's brutally honest about his soul struggles, his inward trials. You ever had any of those? Soul struggles? these inward trials. I like the song written by George Crowley called "Spirit of God, Descend Upon My Heart." Listen to this verse from the psalm. He said, "I ask no dream, no prophet ecstasies. Lord, this is my prayer. I'm not asking you to give me a special dream or a prophet ecstasy, an experience which I'm lifted up like John was on the Isle of Patmos. I ask no sudden rending of the veil of clay, no angel visitant. I'm not asking you to send an angel. No opening skies, but here's what I pray. But take the dimness of my soul away." Here's a man who's saying the same thing Asaph is in our psalm. "Lord, I need help in my soul. I need help in my inward man. Take the dimness of my soul away. Teach me to feel that thou art always nigh," he goes on to say. "Teach me the struggles of the soul to bear." There it is. You ever had any of those? Soul struggles. "To check the rising doubt." You ever had that sense rising within you that says, maybe God isn't hearing you. Maybe he can't take care of you. Maybe this trouble will be the end of you. To check that. To say, stop. To check the rising doubt and the rebel sigh. What's the rebel sigh? It's that God isn't dealing with me appropriately. Lord, you're not giving me a fair shake. That's the rebel sigh. There is a rebel sigh in each one of us. You see it sometimes in little children, don't you? You've heard the story about the little girl who was riding in the car with Daddy, and her daddy said, "Jenny, sit down and buckle up." And she just looked at him. She just glared at him and continued to stand. And he looked at her again. He said, "I said, sit down and buckle up." And she just looked at him again. He finally said, "Jenny, if you don't sit down and buckle up right now, I'm going to pull this car over and give you a paddling." And she sat down with a scowl on her face and buckled up. And then in a few minutes, she looked at him and she said, "Daddy, I'm still standing up on the inside." That's the rebel sigh. That's the rebel sigh. To be still standing up on the inside, that's that attitude we've got to be careful about when it seems that God is distant. Maybe you're going through a particular difficult trouble or trial in your life, and you say, "I've been crying, I've been praying, it seems that no help is forthcoming, I feel like I'm in limbo. I don't sense that nearness of God's presence that I once did. God seems distant from me." The hymn writer says to check that attitude, to check the rising doubt and the rebel sigh, "Teach me the patience of unanswered prayer." You see, that's what the psalmist Asaph is doing in our psalm. He's trying to reconcile his heart with his head, and that's what we need. We need brutal honesty. Now notice the tone of this psalm, starting in the first verse. The first half of this psalm, Psalm 77, gives us a very plaintive and melancholy tone. Actually, you can divide the psalm into two halves. Verses 1 through 9 show Asaph's trouble, his mental anguish. And verses 10 and following show the solution to his problem. Now, what is his problem? He feels God is gone, that God is not listening, that God has withdrawn himself. Will the Lord cast off forever? Sad question. Dangerous question, but yet very real. Have you ever been at a point in your life, maybe you have had an extended trouble or trial, and it seems that you're working through it, but you're getting increasingly weak, you're being worn out by it, it is taking its toll not only on you physically, but on you spiritually. And you're beginning to wonder, why doesn't God do something? Will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Notice that's the question that is troubling this man named Asaph. Like I said, the first half of the psalm, verses 2 to 9, expresses a very plaintive tone. Now, the verse 1, as you'll find frequently in the psalms, is a thematic statement. Frequently in the psalms, the first verse or the first two verses will give you the theme of the whole psalm. And this is the theme of the psalm. Listen to this. "I cried unto God with my voice, even unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me." What's the theme of Psalm 77? That God hears prayer. The theme of this psalm is that when you cry to God with your voice, by the way, that is something each of us should do on a daily basis, especially when you're in a difficult season in your life, you should pray about it. Don't make prayer the last resort. Somebody says, "Well, we ought to pray about it," and someone else responds, "Well, it can't hurt." You know, the Bible says, not that prayer can't hurt, it says the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much. It helps a bunch. It not only can't hurt, it helps. It actually helps. It'll help you to unburden your soul to God, and God actually hears and answers. I am confident, my friends, that God hears the cries of his people. You keep praying and you keep trusting and you keep looking to God to help you solve your problems, and he will hear your prayers. That's the theme of this psalm. I cried unto God with my voice, and he gave ear unto me. By the time we get through with this psalm, that's the lesson that we will be left with. But in the meantime, that's the theme. That's a thematic statement. Notice now, starting in the second verse, he tells us about his mental anguish. And here's what he says: in the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. It's a good thing to do. But listen to this: my sore ran in the night. Now, the answer was not immediately forthcoming. Eventually, God answered his prayer. He heard him all along. He eventually answered, but he says, here are the circumstances in the meantime. In the day of my trouble, I sought the Lord. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. What does that mean? It means he has some kind of medical issue, a wound perhaps that is painful, and he gets no relief from it. He has some kind of disease or illness. Could have been that it was a wound suffered through some accident. It could have been that he had some kind of blood condition or something that is infected, but yet he's physically infirm. My sore ran in the night and ceased not. And listen to this, my soul refused to be comforted. Didn't matter if my wife came in and said, honey, why don't you drink this special green tea? Here's a little ointment that my neighbor recommended that you use. He says, nothing seemed to work. It was taking a toll on my spirit, and I just couldn't find anything to satisfy me. Watch this. Even when I remembered God, says verse number 3, I was troubled. I suggest that somebody said, well, you need to go to church. If you're having trouble and you're getting depressed and you're losing heart, you need to go to church. So he said, when I thought about going to church, I just thought, no, that's not going to help. Somebody says, well, you need God. And he said, okay, when I thought about God, he said, it just added to my anguish. Now, this is a very important point that we need to understand. As this man, Asaph, cannot find any comfort or relief, sleep eludes him. There's a cloud over his soul that dominates his every thought. So he attempts to assuage his inner turmoil by thinking about God, but even that doesn't seem to afford him any relief. And I'll show you why in just a moment. Because the fact is, dear friends, just to think about God in general terms doesn't help you. It's to think specifically. To think specifically about what God has done. To think specifically. Somebody says, you need God. Okay, I need God. God, I need you. But yet, my friends, to meditate on the specifics, that is so vitally important. Now, I don't want to get too bogged down there, but notice this man is tremendously anxious. Notice verse 5 now. He attempts to escape his depression by reflecting on the blessings that he had enjoyed in the past. He says, I have considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. So he says, okay, I'm sinking, I'm depressed, I'm losing heart, I can't seem to find anything, I'll think about God, but yet he's not thinking about anything particularly or specifically, and it doesn't help him. And therefore he says, okay, I'm going to think back on to happier times. I'm going to think back to when I was 25, and I had that wonderful experience, and God answered my prayer. I'm going to try to remember back to the happy days in the past. I've considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. But I want you to notice, dear friends, even when he thinks about the song that God gave him in the night, verse 6, I call to remembrance my song in the night. And isn't it wonderful God gives you songs in the night? There's a lady who's now gone home to be with the Lord that was a widow woman in the church I grew up in Muleshoe, Texas. And she talked about on occasion how that she would be afraid of circumstances outside of her window during the middle of the night, but yet God would give her a song. And as she started to sing that song, she would calm down and go to sleep. A song in the night. Has God ever given you a song in the night, dear friends? There are a bunch of them in our hymn book. I love them. I like songs like Abide With Me, Fast Falls the Eventide, The Darkness Deepens, Lord With Me Abide. Don't you like that? That's a song in the night. The darkness deepens, but Lord, I'm praying for you to abide. What about Be Still My Soul, The Lord Is On Thy Side. Bear patiently the cross of grief and pain. Leave to thy God to order and provide. In every change, he faithful will remain. It's a song in the night. There are many more, but the psalmist says, I call to remembrance. I'm going to remember the song that I sang, but now when he sings it again, it just doesn't seem to get through to him. You see, he's in such a state. His heart is in such a dark condition, if I can say it like this. God is hiding his face, that he says nothing seems to help. When I think about God, that doesn't help. When I think about the days of old, when I think about the song that God gave me in the night, he says, I commune with my own heart and my spirit made diligent search. So what he does here is he is now going to ask himself some very hard questions. When he says diligent search, he means I've made a thorough investigation. I tried to think about, okay, what's going on? Why am I feeling so low? Why am I cast down, O my soul? He's about to investigate his situation, and his diligent search involves asking himself these hard questions that we read as our text this morning. Will the Lord cast off forever? He's investigating. Will he be favorable no more? He's asking himself. I suggest that instead of doubting, he's reasoning. He's debating with himself. He's saying, okay, you feel that God has abandoned you, but will God actually abandon his children? He's applying what he knows to how he feels. He says, will the Lord be favorable no more? Is this like God to just quit being gracious? Is that the way God acts? Is that God's modus operandi? Does he bless you for a while and then say, okay, I think I'll just forget about him for the rest of the time? Is God that kind of God, or is he a permanent, consistent, perpetual friend? Will anything separate you from his love, is what I'm asking. No, my friends. So as he debates with himself, he reaches the conclusion that because of God's nature, it is impossible for God to abandon his people. These verses, verses 7 through 9, are an example of how faith focuses on the truth, how it mounts the upper skies, as the hymn writer said. Faith mounts the upper skies, how it rises above the vain and transitory elements of this world, and even when feelings sink very low, faith triumphs over our feelings. I wonder if you've ever heard this old story about the three men walking on the wall. Would you listen to this? Three men were walking on a wall. Feeling, fact, and faith. These are their names. Feeling, fact, and faith. When feeling got an awful fall, and faith was taken back. Faith was so close to feeling that he stumbled and fell too. But fact remained and pulled faith back, and faith brought feeling too. So, Brother Mike, now that sounded like a tongue twister. Well, think about it. Feeling, fact, and faith. And feeling suffered a fall. And when feeling fell, faith fell with it. You ever felt like that? Is your faith tied to your feelings? You say, okay, I believe. I feel, I have a positive feelings. Well, what's going to happen, dear friends, when your feelings sink? Which they will. Do you know what feelings are like? They're like the tides. They come and go. They wax and wane. Feelings are not consistent. Is there anybody in here whose feelings are consistent? We don't live by feelings. We're to live by faith, my friends. You say, oh, my feelings. I'm always on top of the world, Brother Mike. 24/7, 365, I am the king of the world. I just enjoy life. I'm always the same. If you're like me, dear friends, a lot of things can affect your moods. Your feelings are up and down, like a roller coaster, aren't they? This morning, the skies are gray and the rain is drizzling. I don't know about you, but I prefer sunshine and warmth. I just feel better when the sun shines. But the fact is, God has not promised skies always blue, has he? The sun is not always going to shine. Our feelings, if your feelings are tied to circumstances, my friends, they're going to be up and down. And what happens to a lot of people is they say, okay, I think God, I feel his presence. And because I feel his presence, then I know he is present. My faith is strong. But then what happens when God withdraws himself for a little bit, as Asaph is experiencing this psalm? What happens when you don't feel him near? When the fact is it seems that he's absent, does your faith falter then? Faith was so close to feeling, says this poem, that when feeling fell, faith fell too. But fact remained. Here's the hero of the story. Fact. Truth. Not feelings, but fact. Fact remained and helped faith up. And that brought feelings too. You know how to feel better, dear friends? Just keep looking at the facts. Looking at the facts, not at your feelings. Here's what I'm trying to say this morning, dear friends, is that regardless of how we feel, here's a wonderful fact that will never change. I am persuaded that neither death, nor life, nor angels, nor principalities, nor power, nor things present, nor things to come, nor height, nor depth, nor any other creature shall ever be able to separate us from the love of God, which is in Christ Jesus our Lord. How wonderful is that truth? You say, well, I don't feel like that's going to happen, but I believe the fact. Faith is tied to the fact. You know, when I was in high school, our football team's motto my senior year was, I believe. And the coaches printed these placards and signs. We put them on the back of our helmet, I believe. We put them on the above the doorway from the dressing room out to the field, I believe. We had big signs made that were strung on the fence around the football field, I believe. And everywhere you looked, we would chant, I believe, I believe, I believe. We believed. We won one game and lost eight and tied one. 1-8-1 my senior year. I don't know what it was we believed in, but it didn't help us much. You see, we had faith in faith. We worked ourselves into a frenzy. We were looking for it toward our feelings. We said, I believe, I believe, I believe. And as you chant that together, then you get yourself worked up into this psychological state of mind that says, yes, I can. It's just nothing more than positive thinking. Paul said, I believe God. You see, there's something substantive there. I believe God. When he was on that ship and the ship was going to sink and he told the men, I believe God, that it shall be even as it was told to me. He didn't just say, I believe. Let's just have confidence. Let's just believe in a fairy tale or in a pipe dream. Let's have a little bit of faith and trust and just a little bit of pixie dust. Paul said, I believe God. That anchor, my friends, is in something solid. That's in the bedrock of fact, of divine truth, that God is real. So here's this man who's wondering, where is God in my troubles? And I want you to notice that Asaph, in verse 10, reaches a turning point. And I said, this is my infirmity. And what that word infirmity means is, this is my disease. He understands that he's having these feelings because he has this physical problem. He understands his spiritual depression is directly tied to his physical sickness. You know, it's important, my friends, to understand that bodily weaknesses have a way of coloring everything else in our lives into the gray hues of despair. Andrew Bonar paraphrases the words of the psalmist when he says, my present circumstances of body have averted my soul from God's love. That is, they've averted my understanding, my perception of God's love. He comes to a turning point. This is my infirmity. The reason I'm having these troubles in my heart is because of the disease that is taking its toll on me. But he says, but I will remember, watch this, not just God. I remembered God is what he said in verse 3. Now he says, I will remember the years, he gets specific, of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. And this is so important, my beloved. It's so important to learn to think specifically. Let me, as we try to wrap this psalm up this morning, let me give you three basic helps when it seems that God is absent. Here's the solution. Like I said, verse 10 begins the point in the psalm where his thinking changes. And he says, the reason I'm having these troubles is because I'm sick. That's challenging my whole attitude and outlook on things. He says, here's what I'm going to do. I will remember not just God. I'm not just going to think about the past and how happy I was back then, because that just compounds my misery. He says, I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. Interestingly, the first half of the psalm, the word I or me, the personal pronoun, the singular pronoun, I or me, occurs 18 times in the first half, with only 6 references to God. In the last half of the psalm, there are 21 references to God and no personal references at all. See how his focus has changed? Instead of looking inside of it and seeing his feelings, am I happy? Do I feel God's presence? Do I think God is near? He says, instead of looking inside, he now looks at the facts, at the truth of who God is. And he starts thinking about the years of the right hand of the Most High. That word years, interestingly, means changes or revolutions. I will remember how one year moves to the next, in other words. You ever heard that old saying, this too shall what? Pass. Seasons come and go. Life changes. Maybe you're in the middle of a winter time in your life. You say, I just don't like winter. Well, most of the time, people that complain about one season complain about all the seasons, right? I don't like winter. And then it comes summertime, they say, I just don't like summer. It's too hot. I don't like winter. It's too cold. I don't like spring. My allergies, you know, just go haywire. We need to learn to be content with the seasons of life, right? Because here's one fact about seasons. Whatever your circumstances right now, it's going to change. Seasons will come and go. While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, summer and winter, night and day, cold and heat shall not cease. You're going to keep cycling and revolving. So if you're in a season of your life right now, you say, Brother Mike, we're at a point in our life where we just don't have much money and we're just having to work 60, 70 hours a week and we're just trying to keep our heads above water. Or maybe you're in a season of your life where you say, Brother Mike, my body's starting to break down. I'm having one doctor appointment after the other and just seems that this season, I wonder if it's ever going to end. If that's your experience, dear friends, be sure of this. It's a season. It's not a permanent set of circumstances. It's going to change. This too shall pass. And you say, that's just what I feared, that it would change and it just got worse. Well, sometimes it does that too, doesn't it? But here's the point. I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High, how that God, in every season, his grace is new, his grace is sufficient. As one year moves to the next, I'm focusing on the future. He says, I'm going to reflect on the fact that this season and the providence of God will change. Winter will necessarily turn into spring again. The person who wondered if they could make it through the cold blast of winter now sings with the Shulamite in Song of Solomon chapter 2, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. The time of the singing of the birds is come. The flowers appear upon the earth and the earth gives a good smell. The garden of God will flourish again. Watch this. He's going to get very specific. And what is he thinking about specifically in the last half of this psalm? He's remembering the wonderful works of God in the history of the children of Israel as he led them through the wilderness. So that's the first thing I would say, is that if God seems to be especially absent, I want you to think specifically. Somebody says, okay, I'm going to pray. But then what do you pray about? You say, okay, pray. Dear God, I don't know what to say. Dear God, thank you for life. Bless us. Okay. I don't feel any better, Brother Mike. You've got to be specific. Remember who your God is. Dear God and Father, thank you for calling me your child. Thank you for allowing a sinner like me to come into your presence. And Lord, you see my circumstance. You know my struggles. You know what I'm going through in my heart. And Lord, I don't know how it can all work out, but I'm trusting you. And I'm remembering that the God I'm praying to is the same one that led the children of Israel through the wilderness. That's what Asaph does in Psalm 77. He remembers specifically that the God that he was looking to for help is the God who brought the children of Israel across the Red Sea. Listen to a couple of interesting verses now in this last half of the psalm. I will meditate of all thy works, says verse 12. I will talk of all thy doings, very specifically. He says, thy way, O God, is in the sanctuary, verse 13. Who is so great a God as our God? Now look at verse 19. Thy way is in the sea. God's way, God moves in the sanctuary, God moves in the sea. Thy way is in the sea, and thy path in the great waters, and thy footsteps are not known. Here's what I suggest to you. First thing you need to do is start thinking specifically. Second thing you need to do is go to the house of God, because God's way is in the sanctuary. Is God moving in this world? You say, I don't know. I think this world's getting so bad, Brother Mike. It looks like the devil's moving. He's active, but I wonder if God is active. Where can you see evidence that God is moving? God's way. Where can you find God's way in this world? Right here. That's right. In the house of God, because his way is in the sanctuary. That means, dear friends, that if you want to get close to God again and want him to be close to you, the place you're going to find him is not down at the honky-tonk or in the movie theaters. Not that there's anything necessarily wrong with seeing movies. It's not sitting by a creek bank. You say, I just feel so close to God in nature. That's fine until you're going through a hard time in your life and it doesn't matter what you try, it doesn't seem to help. The best thing you need and that I need is to come back to the place where he manifests himself, in the house of God. This same man, Asaph, back in Psalm 73, we're in Psalm 77, go back a few chapters, Psalm 73, he says, I was envious. You talk about a brutally honest man, a man who just exposes his heart to the rest of us so that we can learn from him. I mean, it's like he doesn't put up any subterfuge or any, he's not trying to hide behind a veneer. He's just brutally honest. He's saying, I want you to look at my heart, Psalm 73. He's saying, I was envious at the foolish when I saw the prosperity of the wicked and my feet were almost gone. He's telling us about an experience in his life in which he was standing on a banana peel. He was about to slip. His feet were almost gone because of his bad attitude. He was saying, look at these people living so sinfully and yet God is blessing them. Why am I serving God? I've cleansed my hands in vain. I've washed my hands and I'm trying to do right and all I get are troubles and problems and these people out here don't seem to care and there are no bands in their death. They are prosperous. They're not in trouble as other men. And he says, I was envious when I saw the prosperity of the wicked and I thought, what's the use in serving God? He's exposing an actual psychological struggle in his life for our understanding. And listen to what he says. My feet were almost gone. And he goes through and talks about in Psalm 73 that experience until he says, "This I was in trouble until I went into the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their end." You know what he means? He means I was about to lose my mind until I went back to church and heard the preacher preach that the wicked, though they have their good portion in this life, yet their evil day is coming. And he said that it's only temporary. And it's not that I want them to hurt, but I was able to see the big picture again that serving the Lord is never in vain. It was in the house of God he was reminded of that wonderful truth. God's way is in the sanctuary. God moves in his church today. You say, Brother Mike, seems like God is far away. Then come to the house of God. You will find him in the singing of the hymns. You will find him in the public prayers. You will find him in the preaching of his word. You will find him in the love and fellowship of the saints. You say, I didn't find him today, Brother Mike. Then come back next Sunday. Right? Because here's his promise. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. It's not a promise to the dead sinner. He's talking to a church when he says that. He's telling his church, I'm knocking on the door, and if any one person, if any man, that's you sisters, that's you brethren, if any of you, this verse forever disqualifies us from saying, I didn't get a blessing because so-and-so was there because the preacher didn't do very good. He says, if any man will hear my voice and open to me, I will come in and sup with him and he with me. You come back next Sunday and Christ makes tracks in the sanctuary. He may go to pew number 5, seat number 3, right where you are, and sit beside you, and you'll say, oh, I had sweet fellowship with God today. I found the Lord at Old Bethel Church. I found him there. And you'll go home saying, my heart is warmed. I'm so glad I went to church today. Now I know that God is with me. I have a sense of his presence again. His way is in the sanctuary. Lastly, look at this, verse 19. His way is in the sea, and his footsteps are not known. You know, again, he's drawing his lesson from the story of Israel coming out of Egypt. And as the children of Israel wandered through the wilderness, God manifested himself in the tabernacle, in the sanctuary, in the house where he promised to put his name. And the people saw the Shekinah glory there. They could meet God in the sanctuary. But I'll tell you, another place that they could meet God is in the ways of providence. His way is in the sea. You know what this means? It means that God's providence is mysterious because his footsteps are not known. It is from this verse that William Cowper writes these words. Listen, will you? God moves in a mysterious way. His wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Now, what happens if you put your foot in the water? What happens if you step in the mud? If you plant your footsteps in the mud, what happens? It leaves an imprint, right? But what if you walk in the water? What happens? There's no trace. The water comes back in. You can't see any footprint. That's the way God moves. He moves mysteriously in our lives. You say, well, I wonder what God is doing. I wonder why he's so far away from me. You've got to trust him, dear friends, because he moves in mysterious ways. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Listen, deep in unfathomable minds of never failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. This is a song describing what we call the doctrine of providence. God's providence, that is, that God is actively involved in our lives, even though you can't see him. Did you know there's a book in your Old Testament that never once mentions the name of God? What would a book be doing in the Bible that never once mentioned the name of God? It's the book of Esther. The book of Esther. God's name is nowhere to be found in the book of Esther, but God's hand is all through that book. I mean, God preserved the Jews from Haman's dastardly plot to exterminate them. Haman hated Mordecai. And he wanted to kill the Jews, but God protected them because the king's own wife was beautiful Esther, Mordecai's niece. And Esther came before the king, and of course the story is that as she begged for her people, he gave her a solution to the problem, and God protected, even though God's name is never mentioned. I want to tell you that the book of Esther is a lot like life. God's name is not always mentioned, but I'll tell you, his hand is everywhere. Can you see it? His hand is at work in your life. Can you see it? Providence means that we can't always trace him. About the time that you think God has abandoned you and forgotten you, I'm telling you, dear friends, he is treasuring up his bright designs and working his sovereign will. And I love then what he says in the next verse, ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and shall break in blessings on your head. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense. Don't just say, okay, I'm going to try to figure him out. And because he will work deliberately. He will do it another way than you had thought that he would, just to show you that he's in charge and you're not. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense, but trust him for his grace. That is, if God loved me enough to give me grace in Christ, then he loves me enough to take care of me right now. Behind a frowning providence, it appears he's not happy, he's not watching, he doesn't care about you. Behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. That's so true. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Blind unbelief is sure to err. and scan his works in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. Because God's ways are in the sea, we must live by faith. Though we cannot trace his hand, we cannot find out his steps, we must, my friends, trust his heart. Charles Spurgeon said it like this: God is too good to be unkind, and he is too wise to be mistaken. So when you cannot trace his hand, trust his heart. My friends, here are the solutions when God seems to be absent from you. Think specifically. Start reviewing the actual stories of the Bible, the actual attributes of God, the actual promises. Don't just say, I'm going to think about God, but actually get into the Word and read about God and meditate on the particular specific promises that are given. But secondly, dear friends, go to the house of God and be in the presence of God's people, because that's where God moves in his church. You'll find guidance there. You'll find understanding. You'll find peace. You'll find strength. And then, my friends, live by faith, because God moves in a mysterious way. Remember the words of Job again. I go forward, backwards, left, right, seeking God, but nowhere can he be found. But he knows the way that I take, and he knows the way you take, my friend. And when he's ready, you will come forth as gold.